This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abuhul, John McDonald, and the rest of the team.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And welcome back to Talking of Books. We are in the studio. I'm joined with my co-host, James Mullen. We've got Aidan Lake still with us. Prachiti has sadly left. But we've got, coming in place of Prachiti, or are you taking her place? I don't think you're taking her place so much. Ganza Garai.
I can never take anybody's place.
No. A regular visitor to the show. And you're going to be talking to us a little bit later on about A Strangeness in My Mind, a book which you reviewed and covered for the show a couple of months ago. But I think what we could do, James, is have some news, some book news.
Yeah, let's start with some book news. And breaking news, J.K. Rowling, the writer, is writing books. Yes, I mean,
is
it's caused this. Well, apparently it was. There was much of a storm. Again, back to our social media. On social media, when she mentioned that she's actually writing two novels at the moment, she seemed to be taken aback a little bit by the fact that this was actually news. But this is the nature, as we know, of social media these days. So she's writing these two books. I mean, she obviously had a busy 2016. She had the release of The Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, a movie that I went to see, it was a couple of weeks ago, with the kids, with a bunch of sort of 12 and 13-year-olds. It's interesting, I'm not really...
Was it really for children? I watched it, I loved it.
Yeah.
But
well, that sort of age range, believe it or not, it's about perfect for them, about 12 or 13.
Okay, well, I'm obviously 12 or 13 years old.
And, I mean, it's interesting, because I'm not a huge sort of fantasy fan. I mean, I appreciate J.K. Rowling, I think she's a great writer and all of that, but I thought the movie was terrific. It was really good. And what was interesting for me as well was that it was the discussion that I listened into with the kids on the way back, and because it did prompt a lot of discussion. It's a really smart film. It's actually a political film as well. It's a film with heart, it's a film with head, and it's a film with wit as well. So if you haven't seen it already, I would definitely recommend it, because you know some of the themes there that she picks up are themes that are going to be relevant, very relevant over the next 3 or 4 years, and that was the thing I think that I most enjoyed about it, was the fact that the teenagers sort of picked up on that.
This is that whole sort of power, the abuse of it, and the manipulation
exactly.
of it. It's really clever, I think, Aidan. I'm sure you'll agree with me that the way that Fantastic Beasts has been written, it's almost for the book. It's almost as if it was written for the same generation that started with Harry Potter, and it's kind of just has flowed on towards that.
I definitely feel that. I'm of the generation that grew up with Harry Potter, or slightly older than that. I guess my younger sisters, I was just borrowing the books from them and loving them as well. And yeah, I totally feel that. I feel like this is it's the sort of grown-up Harry Potter that I never quite got from the original series. I enjoyed it a lot more, certainly, than any of the films of any of the Harry Potter films. I think Fantastic Beasts just a step up in quality, but
it was
also
just great,
a natural
it?
Continuation.
Mm. And so imaginative. I think that's what I really enjoy. I went and watched it with my son, who is 27 odd, and my husband, and we loved it. We absolutely loved it. We were enthralled with it. You just suspend all sense of what your reality is, and you just get sucked into this wonderful world. I believe that they now have published the script of the movie. So we have Fantastic Beasts and whatever the thing is. We've got the book. Mm. We've got the movie, and now we've got the script of the movie.
Yes, I think so.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, anything that J.K. Rowling writes, I mean, she could publish a shopping list, I think, and it would be auctioned for thousands of pounds, you know?
Just yesterday, I was reading some complaints about the site Goodreads has a Best Books of the Year thing every year, and people were complaining that for the fantasy books, no one stood a chance because the Cursed Child script, which people were complaining about the plot of that, but nevertheless, the number of fans elevated it straight to the top of over kind of actual fantasy novels that were supposed to be competing for the award.
Yeah, you know, isn't it funny? Because I haven't read that, and I read scripts all through the year. I read an awful lot of scripts, but for some reason, that wasn't a script that appealed to me. I just...
But everything I've heard about it suggests that it's a spectacular production, but the actual script could possibly have used...
A bit of help.
Yeah, just there's people. I've definitely seen people complaining about some of the plot developments, and
it's also worth remembering. I don't. J.K. Rowling didn't actually write the script, did she? I think she wrote it with someone, and I think it was more with than, you know, her sort of.
Well, film is always a collaborative business, as they say. So you know, you rarely, you know, the writer rarely gets carte blanche on it. There will always be people getting involved, and obviously the director will have their own view on it. But I thought, and in the movie itself, it was beautifully played. Actually, I mean, the acting was tremendous in it. You know, across the four lead characters, the four main characters in it. So as I say, I mean, if you haven't seen it already, I think it's still playing in the cinemas at the moment. It's a recommendation. Give yourself a treat. You know, New Year's Day treat tomorrow. Go and see it.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good plan. If you haven't done that, do that. We've also got some other sort of sad book news, I suppose, literary news. We've recently heard of the death of, I think, a most beloved author, Richard Adams, who has written some rather magnificent books, certainly books that had me weeping through my childhood. Aidan, you can shed a little bit of light into the books that he's written.
Well, mainly Watership Down, which is the only book of his that I've read, but I read it obsessively throughout my childhood.
So beautiful.
It was possibly among the first books that I read that had really detailed world building and into rabbits, creatures that we don't take terribly seriously. And he just brought them so vividly to life. He gave them kind of everything, a society, a religion, but he also gave every single rabbit its own personality. And you're moved when bad things happen to them.
A lot of bad things happen to them. Honestly, I honestly wept through that book when I read it, and that was I think I must have been about 13 when I read that. And oh my goodness, it was just so sad. did anybody here read Shardig and the Plague Dogs? Honestly, do. They are the most beautiful, beautiful. All his books are sad, make no mistake. He writes very sad books, but he writes them with such empathy and compassion and understanding of human nature, which he then obviously puts into the animal sort of kingdom. But that whole community with the rabbits, with their warren, and when they start losing, you know, when they start getting dug up, and it was just tragic.
I mean, you know how it began. You know how Watership Down began.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it him telling stories to his children?
Exactly. He was on a car trip,
okay,
and he was put on the spot, and he had to make up a story. So he said, I was put on the spot, and I started off once there were two rabbits called Hazel and Fiver, and I just took it on from there. So it was but it happens a lot, I think, in children's fiction generally, that this is how many authors. I mean, Andy Stanton, the guy who'll be coming to the Litfest in March, I think it was his nephews and nieces that he began telling stories to. That's where it came. So that actually happens quite naturally. But I wonder did he give some of the royalties to his kids then? You know, but he lived to a pretty ripe old age, actually, 96. You know, and the book, he actually wrote it in 72. So that's, what, 44? So he wrote it when he was in his 50s.
Yeah. He does say that if he had realized that he was a good writer, he would have started writing a lot sooner.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. But he hasn't written an awful lot recently. To be honest with you, I had thought that he had already passed away, because I hadn't come across any of his books in the last sort of 10 years or so. So for me, you know, I was genuinely surprised. I suppose he had a few really good books in him, and that was his. I mean, he's written quite a few, but there's just those few that are really well known.
Yeah, I mean, he was also a leader in the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. So you know, the focus on protecting animals was an area for him. But he had other interests as well, and I presume, you know, bang out a best-selling book, take the money, relax. I mean, who wouldn't? That sounds like a pretty good recipe to me. You know, go and do what you want to do at that stage. You know, so you're right. Maybe, you know, that obviously he didn't start writing until his best-selling book was published when he was in his 50s. there wasn't this pressing need for him to produce novels. He wasn't one of those writers who went, oh, I must get up every morning and write. But yes, I mean, he leaves a strong legacy. I just wonder, is Watership Down widely read now still by kids?
I think so. It's always on kind of classic children's literature mm-hmm. lists. It's always in libraries. I'm sure school librarians recommend it to people whenever possible. I'm just seeing on the news here that there's apparently a new TV series coming out, which has a lot to live up to, since it's got both the book itself and the film.
Wasn't it?
Oh, it was stunning.
The film,
yeah.
I think it's hard going. I can't remember much about it apart from the scene in the Warren at the start.
Yeah.
No,
the song
as well.
Yeah. Bright Eyes. I mean,
yes. Art Garfunkel.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine how these guys putting together the new animated TV series must be working hard to make sure it's decent.
Yeah, but I mean, the quality of animation that you can do these days. I suppose, although sometimes you get a bit tired of it, you know, it's actually too easy.
I absolutely don't.
Do you not?
I'm going to go and watch it and weep
and
enjoy it. I think I love what you can get out now with CGI and cartoons, and it's just incredible. I mean, we go back to that Fantastic Beasts. Those look so real. You feel as though you're going to stroke them and all their fur is going to fluff up, and you know, while you're doing, especially when you've got it with 3D, it's amazing.
Mm.
And it is a treat. It really is. Have you got some more book news for us, James?
From Watership Down to James Joyce. It's the centenary of the publication of A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and so they're doing some map project around Ulysses as well, I think. Which should be interesting to a certain group of readers. I don't know. I mean, I've tried Ulysses, I don't know, half a dozen times, and I think I got up to about 100 page 150, and it should be easier for me
because
I'm from there, yeah. And the book begins at this Martello Tower in Sandy Cove in Dublin. That's where I grew up. I used to play there as a kid, so the geography is, I know the whole area really well. So I mean, I think he's a fantastic writer. I mean, if you are going to read James Joyce, read A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, or read the short stories Dubliners. Dubliners
Very
are fantastic.
Good.
They're excellent. And then if that appeals to you, yeah, have a go at Ulysses. But forget about Finnegan's Wake. Don't even think about it.
Okay, so guys, don't read Finnegan's Wake. Read the others. And we will come back to you after this short break.
From Agatha Christie to Jeffrey Archer, we've got it covered. Talking of books.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
On Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
Welcome back to the show. A quick reminder on the quiz question. John Ronson, who we discussed earlier on the show, the question is he coming to the Lit Fest in March? Very simple. Mr. Google might be able to help you on that one. So go and have a look and send in your responses on that. So we're now moving on to the next book, which I think is in joint fourth place. And this is A Strangeness in My Mind by the celebrated Turkish author, Orhan Pamuk. And to help us discuss this, we are delighted to formally welcome Gamze. Welcome, Gamze.
Thank you.
So, A Strangeness in My Mind. Tell us a little bit more about this then.
Happy New Year to everyone. First of all, I think it's an important day for all of us, and that's a kind of strange title to start discussing the book, A Strangeness in My Mind, which is, I think we have all strangeness in our minds from time to time.
Speak for yourself.
Okay. I speak for myself.
Yeah. I'm with you. Yeah.
All right. probably you have heard of Orhan Pamuk before, because he is the first and only Nobel Prize literature owner, Turkish author at the moment. And his book, A Strangeness in My Mind, is beautifully translated to several languages. I was lucky to read it first in Turkish in my own native language, and then in English, when actually Penny gave me the copy in English. And I just realized that how wonderfully it got translated to English, because otherwise I think if you write in another language and if you can't really speak that language, then it's very hard to enjoy the book.
That's
if the translation is not really good.
That's really interesting, because mainly through a couple of the books that we've read this year, I've started paying more attention to who the translators are of books, because I think there's a skill involved in that, particularly when the languages are such complicated languages, or the societies that they come from, then the social structure and the traditions are so very different to, say, for whatever the language that you think and speak in. It's important to get the feeling of the language correct as well as the meaning of the story.
I agree.
You reckon they've done
yeah,
that.
I think we need to give a lot of credit to translators in every language, then I realize that, to enjoy a book in any language at the end of the day. And this is a book of a simple love story, it looks like, at the background, but it's actually an epic story of a city, of a country. 50, 60 years of a story of a country, especially the story of Istanbul. James, you were talking about James Joyce. Orhan Pamuk is very famous. They say it's James Joyce of Turkey, because what James Joyce did for Dublin, he did for Istanbul at the end of the day. In many of his books, he's talking about his love and passion for the city. I'm an Istanbulian myself, so I can understand and identify myself with his way of writing.
Yeah, I mean, the book has been referred to as a bit of a you know, a love letter to Istanbul,
a city, yeah.
Itself, and it's of his novels is the most sort of focused on the city and what it was like and how it is. I mean, how did it resonate to you then?
See, living in Istanbul, I think, for more than 30 years continuously, and then going back and forth all the time while I was living in Dubai. So for me, it's a place where I was born, where I was raised up. And then I can actually very much identify the little details that he's mentioning in the book. And if you're a tourist, we were talking even last time, and if you're a tourist going to Istanbul, and if you read one of Orhan Pamuk's books, either non-fiction or fiction, you can really see the details.
You don't just see it, you can almost feel it. You can feel the little roads, you can feel the street vendors, you can almost smell the Bosphorus. I mean, it's really flowing through his book.
And interestingly, in this book, that's the first time he's talking about the story of an ordinary man. He was usually writing in his books the lives of bourgeoisie, which is
his class that he understands.
His class and like
privileged people.
He was born and raised up in a part of Istanbul which is a bit more sophisticated, which is called Nishantaşı, Teşviki, which he talks more about in his books. And that's the first time he's talking about the really like a very ordinary man, the story of every man actually, what they call a street vendor, who is selling yogurt, peas and rice, and the famous boza. I don't know if you tasted boza in your life before, because it's very hard to describe. Last time I was trying to describe, and then it was too tasty. I'm really feeling and sensing the taste in my mouth. It's a fermented wheat or maize, which is a bit acidic and a bit sweet, topped with cinnamon, and you can put peas and cinnamon on it, on top of it. And the taste, it's thick. It's not sweet, it's not acidic, it's in between. But it's a bit cold, and you drink it in the cold winter days. And I know nowadays, and today it's snowing in Istanbul, and on a snowy day, you can actually call a street vendor passing through the street, and they're called bozacı. And from the window, you can call them, like in old times, bozacı. And then they actually can come and then bring you the boza, the fresh boza. My father used to do that when I was a child. And nowadays, you don't have many street vendors selling bozas in Istanbul. I mean, it's mainly kind of nostalgia at the moment. But then you can go to any different stores and buy boza yourself, because there are really famous places which are selling bozas. And if you never taste it, it's really something different.
But in the book, the thing with me with the boza is that you have to carry it. I mean,
you have to carry on your shoulder
these buckets with boza in them.
And on really dark nights, and they do this, and it's really, there is nobody in the streets, and the poor street vendor actually is facing lots of different adventures on a dark night, and he has his own dreams, his own life, and vision in life, which he called a strangeness in his own mind, but which actually not a strangeness, his own feelings, and like a bit of melancholy in his mind about his own life.
He's a bit naive, isn't he? He's naive.
He's very naive.
And
he's very happy to be naive as well.
Yeah, but he does get taken advantage of. And people around him, what you see a lot in this book is the politics and the growth of Istanbul as a city, how plots were allocated, how the municipalities manipulated and worked the community, how the community manipulated the municipalities, how people manipulated each other.
It's the whole overall story of a city, and at the background, the country even. Like, there are different events and things happening throughout 60 years, and he is actually experiencing each of them from his own perspective. And the interesting, one of the other interesting things, it's a very polyphonic novel, and then every character is actually telling the story from their own perspective, what they see and experience.
Yeah, so what you have is the story being told from the main character's point of view, and every now and then you'll get a chapter which is you know, breaking through that sort of fourth wall and coming out and telling you his story as well. So it is lovely that you do get these little snippets all the way through. And the nice thing about that is that you start to get the character, the main character, I can't remember his name now.
Mevlüt.
You start getting a fuller picture of his character from all of the opinions of all the people around him. Because when you first start reading the book, you think he's quite bright, don't you? You think, oh, well, he's done well in the village. He's going off to this big city. He's going to finish his education. And he turns out to be not as bright as he thinks he is.
Yeah. And lots of frustrations, I think, a broken heart in a way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's lovely that, because his character evolves and your opinion of him evolves as you hear other people's opinions.
Yeah, I mean, with Pamuk, I mean, I think one of the things that when you're reading him, one of the things that he's great about doing is he will involve you in what you think are utterly banal things and get you involved in it. And one of the areas that's been picked up, I think, in this book is the electricity meter reading, for instance, where he talks to you about how they do
every
that,
detail of the
detail
meter
of the meter reading, and you think, so you know, you say that I say that, like, you know, electricity meter reading, well, how can you make that interesting? But that's one of the skills, I think. And I think one of the points that you know, many reviewers have said about Pamuk and about this book in particular, has got a sort of a documentary feel to it.
Yeah.
To it as well, you know.
Yeah, so it's like an encyclopedia of a city,
exactly,
and a country, is lots of details. And Orhan Pamuk is interestingly always mentioning in his own speeches and in his own creative, I think, writing classes. He's always mentioning that the book is not its plot. The book is about the colorful things and the details in it.
Yeah.
Because we always think that those are the characters or the plot itself giving, you know, voice to a book, but he's always emphasizing the details are so important. And he's a very detailed oriented writer in every book. It's a bit difficult to read, like maybe James Joyce to some extent. There are guides for those writers, James. I mean,
yes.
I have actually read a guide how to read James Joyce.
Yeah, I've got one of those as well.
And there are
and
also
I'm
books
Irish
about Orhan Pamuk. It helps a lot to see.
But I disagree with you a little bit, because I found reading this book particularly easy.
This is an easy one. This is an easy reading.
You get sucked into the story. You get sucked into the descriptions of the places, and you can almost feel yourself turning the corners and discovering the people, knowing what the schools were like, imagining how cold it is in winter and what shoes they're wearing and the gloves that they've got on and the people that they bump into. And you really are sucked into it. The difficulty is that it's a broad scope book. That's
it's a 600 pages. Like, that's what we call it, an epic story from the very beginning, I think, from 1969 to 2012.
But it's done incredibly well in Turkey, hasn't it? I mean, is it his most popular book to date?
He has a new book, which is, I think, not translated right now, which is called Woman with Red Hair. And this year was quite popular.
So I think we'll come back to the Woman with Red Hair. We're going to take a short break from talking of books. Join us after the break.
From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
On Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
And welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm in the studio with James Mullen, co-hosting with me today. And we've got, and our guests sort of chairs at the moment, we've got Gamze Garay and we've got Aidan Lake. We're talking about A Strangeness in My Mind, Orhan Pamuk's book, which I think is just delightful and wonderful. And I think we've agreed that it's probably one of the easiest books of his to read. I'm going to just quickly go over our quiz questions. Our first quiz question is John Ronson going to be attending the 2017 Emirates Airline Festival of Literature? And our second question is, what city is A Strangeness in My Mind set? What city is A Strangeness in My Mind set? Gamzee, you were talking very briefly about the fact that there's a new book coming out. He's already written a new book in Turkish.
I'm not sure if it's translated to English. You may need to check it. I read it in Turkish this year, and it was quite famous and popular in Turkey in 2016, one of the best read books. It's mainly a psychological book. It's touching, and it's quite thin. So not 600 pages, I think it's around the 200 pages book, which is, again, easy to read, and it's a nice and delightful, another nice book of Orhan Pamuk.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, in some of the interviews, he was a little concerned when he was speaking to his editors and publishers that the book was a bit too Turkish, but what he found was, they would say, well, hang on a sec, no, that's exactly like, you know, street vendor in Spain, or this is a situation that you would get, if somebody was moving from the country in Italy into Milan, it's the same story.
It's mainly universal, but the street vendor, the type of the street vendor might be unique. Someone who is selling boza, which might be unique in a country. But still, it gives kind of excitement, and you want to really read it because this is something that you're not familiar with. I think it gives some kind of excitement if you read something you're not familiar.
Maybe it'll help the sales of boza. Maybe the salesman,
probably,
you know.
The boza sales probably increase.
We've got a short audio clip about that book. Yeah, we'll listen to it now.
The paragraph of this book, which gives away all the plot, all the story. To make it as a point that is, in fact, this is the story of life and daydreams of Mevlut Karataş, a seller of boza and yogurt. Born in 1957 on the western edge of Asia, in a poor village overlooking a hazy lake in central Anatolia, he came to Istanbul at the age of 12, living there, in the capital of the world, for the rest of his life. When I gave the first draft of the book to my publisher in Istanbul, they were upset by living there in the capital of the world. Calm down, Orhan. Calm down, they said. Istanbul is getting glamorized. Aren't you exaggerating a bit? I insisted. As you see, I won. When he was 25, he returned to the province of his birth, where he eloped with a village girl. Now we reach page 200. A rather strange affair that determined the rest of his days. Returning with her to Istanbul, he got married, 250, and had two daughters, 400. He took a number of jobs without pause, selling his yogurt, ice cream, and rice in the street and waiting tables. But every evening, without fail, he would wander the streets of Istanbul, selling boza and dreaming strange dreams. And it goes on like this for 600 pages.
Yeah.
And he makes it sound as though it's not a book you want to read.
It's very simple to write 600 pages. He's not doing a great sales job on it, is he really?
No.
But I think that it's one of my favorite books of the year. There's a reason why it's on the show. It is a beautiful, beautiful read. And if you've got a little bit of time, because it is a long book, and I had a quick listen to the audio book, and I think at 21 hours, I think I would stick to reading it. It's too long to listen to be honest. So if you're an audiobook fan, rather read this one rather than listen to it. And also, because of the language and because it's so lyrical, you want to take your times and you want to decide the pace that you're reading at, because it's so beautifully written.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Gamze, if somebody hasn't read any Orhan Pamuk, I mean, is this the book that you would recommend they start with, or is there another book that they should go with?
He has lots of books. He has very beautiful nonfiction books as well. We were actually even discussing last time that there is another book, especially if you want to go to Turkey or visit Istanbul, you can start reading The Memoir and the City, which is a nonfiction book. He's talking about Istanbul itself, which is a very lyrical book. It's very easy to read, and you can really feel the city before you go to the city. I think it might be one of the first books. I loved all his books, actually. I like challenging books. Mm-hmm. Some of his books require some kind of focus on it to understand the metaphors he's using, the style of his writing. spent some time on the details he's working on. He does lots of researches before he writes his books. He really is a very good observer. I know that he's actually even walking in the city, you know, going and taking buses, listening to people and trying to understand everybody's perspective. He's very keen and curious as a personality. So you need to understand his world before he reads his books. That's what I believe in. And myself, I like challenging books and I like spending time on understanding what the writer is talking about.
Yeah, and obviously, he received the Nobel Prize in 2006. When he gained that. And that brought him a level of recognition, obviously, across the world. He was very well known in Turkey up to that point, but that then gives him this global recognition, which has come at a price for him as well. Because I was surprised to learn that he's got a bodyguard with him at all times.
You know, sometimes it happens to different intellectuals and writers in different worlds, and that's the nature of, you know, sometimes expressing yourself. I think in many countries that happens. It's good to have a bodyguard, by the way. You don't have a bodyguard.
You're speaking from personal experience, I'm assuming.
You don't have any bodyguard.
No, I'm nobody.
He's pretty famous, and he's a kind of down-to-earth person at the same time. And I was lucky to work with his brother in the same university. He's an economic professor, academician in the university. I worked with him 1 year. That's interesting. He's not like Orhan Pamuk, because Orhan Pamuk is a literary character. He's more an academician character. But he was interesting to the fact that Orhan Pamuk is mentioning about him in his books, like a metaphor, like a brother, with his name even.
So he
in
would talk
of his
about
books.
The fact that he was in the book.
Did he? Meet a character who is in the books, in some of his books actually. I think My Name Is Red, he's mentioning about the brother, even his mom. Yeah. Name is mentioned in one of those books.
I'm trying to remember, there is one book where he's written a biographical book about his family, hasn't he? About the family, and they're living in the house with the one floor for the grandfather and the
other
floor.
That's Istanbul City and the memoir. When he was talking about Istanbul, he's talking about his family
as well.
It is his family,
yeah. That's the book. It's great. It's a great book. To be honest, I read that before I went to Istanbul for the first time, and that was kind of like really helped me fall in love with it. But this book is more of a picture of Istanbul. It's a more rounded, fuller picture of that city and its history, whereas Istanbul is just his neighborhood and those, you know, where he sort of went and traveled around, whereas this one's fuller. I think if you're going to visit Istanbul and you want to read a novel about it, I think you would agree with me, Strangest in My Mind
is the fiction. And in the book, when they translated, they kept certain words non-translated, like they kept it in Turkish, if you paid a bit attention, like the term hüzün, which is in Turkish means not exactly melancholy, but some kind of sadness and melancholy, which is in the city itself. I always felt it in winter times, especially. Okay. That's the sadness that you have it, I don't know, because of the nature of the city. I have the same feeling for Paris as well. I don't know. For me, it's a sad city. It's not a sunny city, but certain places have their own, you know, characteristics. And when I just think about Istanbul, this hüzün as a concept suits very well the nature. Although when it's sunny, it's really lovely. You know, the sea and the Bosphorus is like dark blue, and the sky is dark blue. It's nothing to do with hüzün or sadness itself. But I think the concept hüzün gives a lot this meaning to the city. And he mentions a lot about hüzün in many of his books, including this one. And Mevlüt has a sad story, if you actually read the whole book of it. And I mean, he got married with a young girl. I think they eloped when she was 13.
Yeah.
But then he realizes she's not the girl actually he fell in love. That was her sister, but he didn't realize.
It was
short sighted.
Love at a distance, wasn't it? Barely knew her. Okay. He'd created.
They were writing
persona.
Letters to each other. And then he was writing to the wrong girl. He was writing to the right girl, but thinking about the other girl.
Right.
Then actually, he realizes
he really
at
wasn't
some point.
The brightest guy. Really
That's really sad. And the wife learns this before she passes away. I mean, she learns about this truth that's the sister, not her. But she didn't really mind. Yeah. Those kinds of little sweet sadness moments, which enrich the novel. I think it gives another meaning to the city itself. I think very easily I can see in this novel, Orhan Pamuk is using boza as a metaphor for the whole city. Not even yogurt or peas on rice, but boza itself. It's a metaphor for
and
the city.
Why do you think he chose that then above anything else?
I think it's very characteristic. Boza, I mean, Salep is characteristic as well, but Salep, you have it in many places. I think boza is very much characteristics of Turkey, although I have read it that it's being manufactured in other countries like Central Asia. But still, when you say boza, I mean, you remember about Turkey. And I remember about, you know, cold nights when my father was buying boza for us.
Yeah.
On a New Year Eve, you drink boza, for example.
Okay.
I mean, with other things.
Yeah.
It's also a little bit of a window into the life of quite poor people.
Yeah. It's quite poor people's life, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, how they live and what their dreams and what their aspirations. And
which are very simple.
It's very simple. And usually the dreams do not come true. They work hard, but they don't really get what they deserve, as mentioned. But he's still very grateful. He doesn't complain about it.
And he is inordinately proud of the work that he does.
Yeah, he's very proud, and he's a nice person, as you say. He is naive. He's cheated. He saw things, but he is still grateful. He lived a life, a decent life, in his own way. Those are the simple things of simple lives, which many of the books I think do not talk about.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, books talk about real characters or very much exaggerated characters, but in real life, People live simple lives.
Yeah, this book is touching. It touches you. It warms you. You fall in love with the city. You fall in love with the people, and with the suffering of his family. You just really embrace them, because it's not melodramatic. It's just this gentle. Not everything that happens in the book is gentle. Don't get me wrong. But there is this time passing of life washing over you, and it is what it is. And the embracing of that, and also the change. At the same time as this, you must remember that during the time that this book was written, the population I think went from something like 3 million to 13 million.
Yeah,
that is a massive change in a city.
It's the period where the city is growing as well, with all the construction and skyscrapers, and it's a transformation of a city from a small city characteristic to a big city nature. Those are the years he actually experienced when he was living in Istanbul, from 1969 to 2012. I mean, I remember some part of it, especially in the 1980s. Lots of changes happened in the city, and then even recently, the whole transformation of the city. And like, if you live there, you watch this. I mean, like, you're living in Dubai, you're watching for the last 14, 15 years, what different changes it's happening. It's the same experience he had it. And he had a nostalgia for the old. I think that's another,
But it's interesting. There was an interview I saw published with him, and one of the interviewer sort of asked him or prompted him to say things were better then, and there shouldn't be as many people as there are now. And he resisted that. He said, I'm whatever, 63 years of age. He said, from when I came, arrived in the city, I think it was 1 million people then, and it's now up to whatever, 14, 15 million now. He said, well, who am I to say that those 13 million people shouldn't be there? What right have I to make that point? Which I think actually is a fair enough point. I mean, there are obviously issues around property development.
I mean, there are lots of immigrants from other cities to big cities in every country.
Yeah.
I think
embracing the change, which I think is important in cities like that.
Yeah.
We're going to come back to A Strangeness in My Mind after we've had this short break.
From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
On Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking about A Strangeness in My Mind by Orhan Pamuk. But before we continue on that, Lyme McGamsey, we'll just reiterate those questions. John Ronson, will he be coming to the LitFest in March? And then the second question is A Strangeness in My Mind by Orhan Pamuk. Where is the novel set? So, meanwhile, back at the novel, A Strangeness in My Mind by Orhan Pamuk. Gamzee, I mean, you've been reading Orhan Pamuk for a number of years now. I mean, how do you think he's developed in that period?
I think when he started, it was his first book, Cevdet Bey and His Sons, was more a family novel, more a kind of in literary genre. He was imitating Thomas Mann in his own way. Then definitely he shifted a bit to postmodern style with these different books like, Silent House. It started with Silent House, different books like Black Book, My Name is Red. And for me, he's trying different styles at the same time. He's quite experimental. And he tries to write different things, not the same thing, although the central theme maybe is Istanbul and, the metaphors look like similar. He's using similar metaphors in many of his books. And if you read many of his books, you can even follow the same metaphors from one book to another. Same characters appear in different ways. He uses colors, he uses names as metaphors a lot. That's what I actually realized. He tries new styles. He's developing himself in different ways. He's quite productive. But he doesn't finish his books in a couple of years. He takes time to write, I think many years. For this book, as far as I remember, it took 6 years to finish the whole book. And he does a lot of research, quite intellectual. He's a good reader. Mm-hmm. He has an office in Istanbul he's using for writing with a fantastic Bosphorus view, a big library. He inherited, I think, from his father, he was mentioning in his Nobel speech as well. And
he goes between the States and...
Between Turkey and States, and he's living, I think, in New York. Right now he's teaching, he was teaching creative writing classes. I'm not sure, like, lately what happened. And he spends a lot of time in Istanbul as well, because that's where he is... Istanbul nurtures him.
Yeah.
I think his inspiration. So he comes quite often and he spends time in those corners we are mentioning.
I mean, has he ever written stories outside of Turkey? So, I mean, if he's based in the States, you would think, I mean, there are immigrants, Turkish immigrants in...
As far as I know, no.
Mm, it's interesting.
There was one city he wrote the book Snow Was Scarce, outside Istanbul, I remember, but not outside Turkey. I don't remember. Yeah. I don't remember.
Do you know what I've just realized, guys? We're also supposed to be talking about another book in this hour, which we haven't touched on at all. So I'm going to give it 5 minutes.
All right.
Just cover it very quickly, which is Broken Mirror Senekal by Elias Kuhuri, which I've read and I loved. In actual fact, I'm delighted that it's next to and sort of joint. Do you say joint third or joint fourth?
Well, let's be generous. Joint third. Yeah.
Joint third with A Strangeness in My Mind. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. It was translated magnificently by Humphrey Davies, who actually attended the translation conference that we held here in Dubai in October, I think it was. And it was really interesting listening to him talking about the business of translation and the relationships that exist between the writer and the translator. I also listened to a little bit of an interview with the translator of A Strangeness in My Mind, and this was interesting because she actually came into the translation process when the book was being written. It had almost been finished, but not quite, so she had some input at that stage in the translation side of it before it had been finished. But with Humphrey Davies, I think he actually translated the whole book. But the idea that these translators create the world that the author has written about, not just changing the language, but changing the whole, writing in such a way that you feel the culture that you're reading about, that you feel the characters in exactly the way that I would hope the mother tongue has been written in for its readers. I really hope that that's how translators treat the books that they translate. And certainly Humphrey Davies does, and you have indicated that the translator of Strangers in My Mind has done the same thing. So that was really delightful. But the book itself is, again, in a similar way to Strangers in My Mind, it's not a love story. It's about a bad relationship with the city of Beirut, and how the sort of
The characters are drawn towards the city and repelled by the city. They love it, they hate it, they can't get away from it, they keep coming back to it. This kind of recurrent issue. And of course with Beirut, with it being in Lebanon, with the sort of whole war that they've had to go through and the suffering that goes on in there, there's a whole lot of subtleties that come in and strained relationships where you have families who choose different sides and who have different political leanings. So you have all of this coming into a story where somebody is looking for redemption in their lives, looking to build bridges with siblings, who, and at the same time trying to stand on their own. So it's a beautiful book, beautifully translated, with lots of character, emotion, just divine. I again would highly recommend it for reading. And if you enjoyed reading A Stranger's in My Mind, you will absolutely enjoy reading.
Yeah, I mean, Elias Koury obviously is one of the leading Arab intellectuals. I mean, World Literature Today described him as arguably the finest Arab novelist. And he was in the thick of the civil war. He was involved in it in a major way. I mean, he actually, he witnessed the Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan. He was a member of Fatah. He actually fought in the civil war in 75 as well, and was injured, and has lived in Jordan and France. So this is a very important book for him. And it's proven to be, again, you know, about this issue of the civil war in Lebanon. There are a lot of novels have been written, a lot of literature, a lot of books have been written about it. But I haven't read this book, but it's
topical now.
Yeah, it's topical.
Comes back to those.
And you know, if you're going to read a book about this, then you know, Elias Koury would probably be the top of your list, really.
If you read this, you get a sense of the politics, and you get a sense of the emotions and the history and what people feel that's living there. And I mean, this story is set between 1975 and 1990, so we are quite far removed in terms of time. But in terms of what's happening at the moment in Lebanon, it's very similar. The whole problem with refugees and the changing of society, it's gone through a whole upheaval in recently, and this is exactly what goes on during this book, and the history of the people and the characters and their stories and the relationships between families and traditions are torn up and pulled in again.
He can be a very witty writer as well. I mean, it's not just, you know, you're writing about civil war. He's somebody who can write with great wit and humor, but also bleakness as well. You know,
there is great humor when you look at the relationships that he has in the book. You know, his brother is referred to, the two brothers are referred to as twins. They're not twins, and it gets quite confusing while you're reading it. But then you see that their fathers almost put them against each other competitively, but at the same time trying to pull them together. It's a very strange family dynamic that goes on. I'm going to come back to it. We need to take a short break. So please do join us on Talking of Books after this break.
This is Talking of Books here on Dubai Eye 103.8.